I'm not used to speaking in public, as you are well aware, but when we first had camp meeting at the campgrounds that we're at right now, the first year, our guest speaker was Morris Benden, and he was known for putting the sermons in the form of parables. And so he wrote a book called Modern Parables. So I'm taking my sermon from his parables that he presented to us. I was in the Empire State Building, riding the elevator to the top to have a look at the gleaming lights of the city, the great New York City. At the 66th floor, the door opened and a famous billionaire walked in. It surprised me that I thought he was out of the country somewhere. Although I recognized him, I didn't want him to know because it might make him nervous. And I was afraid he would vanish. Being alone in the elevator with him, I looked alternately at the walls and at him as we continued on our journey to the top floor. He evidently noticed my gazing at him, for he suddenly broke the silence. "Do you know who I am?" "I'm not sure, but you're certainly handsome," I answered. I wanted to make points with him. We reached the top floor, and as the door opened, I made sure he could get out the other first. Together, we walked to the edge and looked down at the street below. Evidently, my behavior had impressed him, for he turned to me and said, "I have a proposition to make with you." "Really?" I responded. "I hoped it would involve money." "Yes," he says, "I have $1 million that I want to give to you." "Whoa, you want to give me $1 billion? Although I wondered what the catch was in his offer, I feared to offend him by asking. Besides, I had been wishing I had enough to buy a new Jaguar, and I figured that was offer would leave ample more than enough for the cost. I was delighted. But then he continued, "I want to give you the money on two conditions. First, that you promise to spend the entire sum in 1 year." Well, I would have preferred to spend it out the fund over the longer period of time, but I also reasoned that it would be better to have $1 million to spend in 1 year than have no million at all, so I agreed. "Good," he replied. "Now, here is the second condition. At the end of the year, from wherever you are, whether you're in the Far East or the South Seas, wherever you are in Acapulco or Caribbean, you must promise to meet me at the roof of the Empire State Building." "Is that all, Richard? What happens next?" "You'll meet me here, and then you'll jump off the building so you go splat on the pavement below." "Beg your pardon?" I asked. He repeated the condition. "If you do not jump, and there is no way to get out of it, you can't use the billion to get somewhere. I'll push you from the same spot, and you'll still end up at the end of the year." It didn't take me much deliberation to turn to my would-be benefactor and say, "You know something? You're ugly." I turned around and walked back to the elevator. On the way down, I couldn't help thinking about his ridiculous offer, and I wondered if anyone in his right mind would accept such a deal. At the 77th floor, a man dressed in white joined me. Not that he had seen me somewhere before, perhaps in pictures. He smiled and greeted, but I felt reluctant to talk to him, feeling rather distrustful of people in my elevators. Somehow, he didn't seem to mind my apprehension. "I noticed you've been admiring the lights of New York," he said. "Yes," I replied consciously. "They're certainly beautiful." Then he began telling me about a fantastic city that was even better. It sounded unbelievable. 1/5 larger than the state of Oregon? It had to be the most fantastic. Had the most fantastic river running through it. As he described his fruit trees, I could almost taste the fruit. I could imagine the beauty of the scene. "How do I get there?" he asked. You can find the way, only one way through me," he said, "but I'll be glad to take you there." "How far is it?" 105 trillion miles. 105 trillion miles. How would I ever get there in my lifetime? Just then, the elevator stopped at the 66th floor, and another man got on. He He resembled a magician, a black suit, black, pitch black hair, beard and mustache, and a high hat that looked as though he were trying to hide something underneath. As my friend from the 77th floor continued to describe his city, the newcomer watched me with penetrating eyes. Finally, he butted rudely into the conversation. My friend in white politely led him out of the floor. "I have a fabulous city too," he said. "You should see the lights. At night, you can hardly believe the beauty of the place and the fun you have and the stars whenever you get arrive. You don't have to wait." "Well," I questioned, "how do I get there?" "I'll show you the way." "How far is it?" "You could be there in 4 hours."
4 hours?
"Yes. What are you waiting? Let's go right now," I cried. We continued down to the ground floor. While the man in the white disappeared onto the street, the one in black took me to the airport, where we boarded an airplane and flew to Las Vegas, Nevada. We got there at night, the lights were on, and I had more fun than I ever imagined possible. Then I slept until the next day. Finally, when I was wide awake, we looked around. I started through the strolling aimlessly down the streets. To my surprise, I saw a Jaguar agency that offered me a new Jaguar for $1 down and $1 a week. I can hardly believe those terms. For a month, I roared around Las Vegas having a great time. But the strange thing was that the fun ended. There was nothing left. And I discovered, much to my amazement, that all the things I did have fun were enjoyable when I lasted, but they didn't last. Before long, 30 days in fact, I was sick of it all. I wanted happiness, something deeper and more lasting than fun. In complete frustration, I left the town and began the great search. Out on the edge of Las Vegas, I looked at the signposts and noticed the name of that city my friend had from the 77th floor of the Empire State Building in New York had described to me. Surely enough, the sign said that it was 105 trillion miles away. But this time, I didn't care about the distance. I decided that I was going to go there, if it was the last thing I did. Revving up the engine, I headed down the freeway away from Vegas toward the direction of the city. The four-lane freeway was lovely. Even though it didn't have a center divider, I decided I was driving as fast as possible so I could get there as quickly to my decision quickly. But soon after I headed down the freeway, I discovered something terrible. All the traffic came against me, heading towards Vegas. It was like driving the wrong way on a one-way street. Only rarely did a few cars seem to be going in my direction. In fact, because of all the cars racing towards Vegas, I couldn't carry out my original plan of cruising at 90 miles an hour. Instead, I had to edge over on the shoulder, for some of the traffic was way over on my side. And while on the shoulder, I kept going slower and slower, 70, 60, 40, 20 miles an hour. Everybody knows that you can't get to destination 105 trillion miles away for about 25 miles an hour. To make things worse, as I drove along the shoulder around the bend, up headed a huge diesel Peterbilt truck loaded with logs. He swung right over to my side at the highway and onto the shoulder and headed straight for me. Ignoring the honking of my horn, I dreaded the idea of a collision with a diesel truck. So just before we hit, I drove off the shoulder into the ditch. Gravel and dirt scattered all about as I came to a halt, and the fenders of my Jaguar were scratched up. For a while, I sat there, discouraged at the prospects of arriving at the distant city, but my friend's description of the beauty was kept going through my mind. "I better keep on going," I said to myself. So I pulled out of the ditch and headed onto the freeway again, hoping to make better time. But the traffic was still impossible, and once more, I had to crawl on the shoulder at 20 miles an hour. After a few days, another of those diesel trucks roared around the bend, next time carrying a load of hay. It was straight for me. Again, I headed into the ditch. The journey continued. A constant nightmare of going in another ditch. One day I sat in the ditch, thinking of giving up the whole idea, ready to forget trying to reach the city. I heard a knock on the window. The sound surprised me because I hadn't seen hitchhikers on the road. When I looked up, much to my joy, I saw my friend in the white from the 77th floor in New York. Opened the door, I greeted him and said, "Would you like me to drive for you?" Not being sure if the hazards of the road, have you been on this road before? "Yes, I've traveled that way before." "Well," I sighed, "I'm sure making a mess of this trip. I'd very much like you to drive for me." When I slid over to the passenger side, he moved in and took the wheel. As we drove out on the freeway, his sleeve fell back. I saw a big, muscular arm. "What kind of work have you been doing most of your life, anyway?" I asked. "I've been working in a cabinet shop." Then he headed down the freeway at 90 miles an hour. He didn't mind. He didn't drive with a shoulder either. Unable to believe it, I just sat there in amazement. The Datsuns, the Volkswagens, the Hondas, the Lincoln Continentals, the Chrysler Imperials all seemed to stay out of his way. 90 miles an hour, I said to myself. I think we'll get to that city after all. Overjoyed, I wanted to shout at the window, "You should see my driver." I had this spontaneous desire to let everyone know about him. Then one day, as we drove, we sped along, around a bend ahead, another of those impossible diesel trucks. It made no difference. When I drove my car, the truck headed straight for us. Not liking the idea of head-on collision, the diesel truck at 90 miles an hour, I made a lunge for the steering wheel before it got any closer. My driver made no objection, and I took the wheel. He moved right over. I whipped the wheel around as fast as I could, and the tire screeched, and we careened into a ditch. Ditching the car at 90 miles an hour is not advisable. In fact, the gravel almost turned the car over, and the fenders got smashed up against the embankment. As we spun around, somehow we missed the truck. And when the diesel dust had settled, I discovered my driver was still in the car with me. He tapped me on my shoulder and says, "Would you like me to drive again?" "How can we drive this thing?" I said. "The fenders are smashed against the wheel." "Don't worry," he repaired. "I know how to fix them." Much to my surprise, he was an excellent body and fender man. Now, where he ever learned that type of work in a cabinet shop, I don't know. Soon the fenders were out, and we headed down the freeway again. At 90 miles an hour, as he drove, I said to myself, "Now, he did tell me that he'd been over this road already. He must have met the diesels before." And I began to wonder what I'd do if another met another of those trucks. We journeyed along this for several days. I learned that my driver had never forced himself upon me. At any time, I could take over the driving. But each morning, as we started over the day's trip, he asked me if he wanted me to stay with me to drive, and I always said yes. One day, another diesel truck loaded with hay came around the corner. "Now look here," I said to myself, "keep your cool. Don't do anything stupid. Keep your grubby little hands off the steering wheel. He knows how to handle the big diesel trucks. Stay out of his way." But I didn't feel like doing nothing. I wanted to do something myself. Yet, since he had told me that he knew the road from before, I thought, well, let him handle this. I closed my eyes and opened them again. I chewed my nails. I fussed with the seatbelt. What makes this whole situation worse is that my driver got closer to the diesel truck. He accelerated to 120 miles an hour. It took every ounce of willpower, self-discipline, energy, human effort that I had to sit there. Have you ever heard of the situation, don't just stand there, do something? It's really difficult to change it the other way around. It says, don't do something, sit there. Somehow I managed to let him remain in charge. And just before we'd have collided with a head-on, the diesel truck went into the ditch. I couldn't believe it. And as I sped by, I caught a glimpse of the driver. It was the man from the 66th floor in New York. the one who had flown me to Las Vegas, and he had a pitchfork beside him in the cab for the loading hay. Really excited, I thanked my driver. Now, I had even more reason to shout out the window, "You should see my driver. He can meet anything on this road." I even wanted to get the bumper sticker that says, "Honk if you know my driver." We continued this journey day after day. It was a wonderful experience for a while. But then, to my surprise, I began to get bored with the countryside, frustrated from not doing the driving. I got impressed, impatient, and tired of the trip. Naturally, I didn't want to keep admitting that I couldn't do the driving. It damaged my ego, and I wanted to protest. I know how to drive. I'm a big boy now. I've been to driver school. Leaving my driver in control was turning out to be a crucifying experience. I was tired of all the effort that it took for him to do driving for me. Furthermore, up ahead, I saw an amusement park off to the left side. It looked a fabulous place. It had things like Matterhorn bobsleds, jungle boat rides, and more. Although I wanted to stop, I was quite sure that my driver wouldn't turn off the main road. So I tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Pardon me, may I drive?" He never kept me from driving, never took the power of choice away from me, and never made any objections whenever I asked him to take over. When he stepped out of the driver's seat, I grabbed the wheel. To my surprise, the Datsun's VW stayed on my way, slowing down to a turning speed. I swung left down the road towards the amusement park. Coming around the curve, I hadn't anticipated, I drove off a cliff. Down at the bottom of the cliff, as I returned to consciousness, it had smashed my car. My companion tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Would you like me to drive again?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, the thought had crossed my mind." I don't even know if he did it, but somehow he got the car straightened out, the engine running again. Before long, we were heading down the freeway at 90 miles an hour once more. Licking my wounds, I determined never to take the wheel again. My driver never reproached me for the foolishness. But as we went, day after day, I suddenly found myself in the driver's seat without even realizing they had gotten there. I didn't know how it happened. In fact, I didn't even notice my driver at first, because the other cars stayed away from, out of my way. But then I saw another diesel running around the bend up ahead. And whenever I saw those diesels, I always asked myself, who was driving through the driving? Realizing that I was, the thought crossed my mind, you saw how he did it, why can't you do the same? I stepped it up to 120 miles an hour, hit it straight for the truck. That'll make it go to the ditch. The challenge made me feel really good because, after all, I had the first had a lesson on how to handle diesels. So I hung onto the wheel and accelerated up to 120. I don't need to tell you how the rest. We had a terrible head-on collision. I would have lost my life in the horrible crash, but just before the impact, my friend threw himself in front of me and ended up bruised and bleeding. After the debris had settled around me, I was coming to, he said, "Want me to drive?" "Drive what?" I asked. But to my surprise, I found again that he was not only a cabinet maker and body and fender man, but a master mechanic as well. Once more, we headed down the freeway toward the distant city, with my driver behind the wheel. As I looked at the bruises and bleeding wounds, I felt heartbroken and asked him to forgive me. Little by little, we traveled on together. I realized that I had failed whatever I was trying to help do the wheel, whatever it was already promised to do, drive me for me and get me to that city. My failures always come, but not because I don't try hard enough or to drive, but because I fail to let him drive for me. Whatever diesel approaches, whatever is loaded with logs or hay or coal, if it happens to be in the driver's seat by mistake or deliberate choice, I repent and let him take over quickly. The journey isn't over yet, but just the other day, we came to a fork in the road. One road went to the left, down into a second garden, beautiful beyond description. Flowers, golf courses, green lawns, fountains, lakes, and streams, waving palm trees, and a wide 8-lane causeway going through into it. But the fork on the right went off the main pavement onto some gravel. Then up ahead, I saw chuck holes in the road going up a weaving pattern up the mountain. Which road did the driver take? He took the road at the right, the one up the chuck holes. I tapped him on the shoulder and says, "Did you see the other road?" "Yes." "Are you sure you're on the right road? The other way looks like your description of a distant city." "I'm sure I'm on the right road, but if you don't think so, you may drive." "No, please keep on driving." As we continued to wind our way up the mountain, back and forth, higher and higher, I glanced back to those beautiful sunken gardens, and just on the other side, I saw a huge billow of smoke blowing up. It resembled the smoke from burning Peterbilts, diesels, and pitchforks and hay. Now I was determined to leave my driver behind the steering wheel as long as he continued to climb the narrow, winding road. But something exciting had been happening. From the other side of the mountain, glows of glorious light. I can hardly wait to see where it is. It's the most fantastic light, and I get clear glimpses as we come nearer. I have an idea that it must be for that distant city. In the meantime, although I'm no less interested in that city, I'm having a great time getting better acquainted with my driver. And I've learned to know him more and more. I increasingly love him the way I trust him. Just over the mountain is a promised land, lies the holy city built by God's own hand.